310. With us on the House side, we have Representative Lindsey Holmes and Representative Tammy Wilson, Representative Bob Lynn, Paul Seaton, Bob Herron, myself, Wes Keller, John Ellis, Senator John Ellis, and Senator Fred Dyson. And I expect that we'll be joined here shortly by Senator Davis, who will be chairing the first section. The purpose of the joint meeting, this meeting here at first, will be to hear a report from the Children's Justice Task Force, which I believe many of you are here to see. And for those of you that may be here to hear the House bills in the House HES Committee, that will probably start about 4 o'clock. The first joint session will gavel out, and then will be a short recess, and then we'll reconvene in the House. And the two bills up there are HB 89, related to Vocational Rehab Committee, and SB 101, which is related to questionnaires and surveys. The reason I'm bringing that up now is that if you happen to be here to testify on SB 101 in particular, I will not close the public testimony on that bill today. It will get started on it. So if you're here and you're here to testify, we would appreciate, you know, if you might hold your testimony for the next time we get together on that. There'll be plenty of notice, it'll be well notified, and we'll have a good discussion on that bill. I think everybody's introduced and we're ready to roll. So I think what I'm gonna do is we're gonna go ahead and ask the Children's Justice Task Force to come up, and then I may interrupt briefly to pass the gavel when Senator Davis gets here. So if you would come up and introduce yourselves for on the record and proceed with your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Dr. Kathy Baldwin-Johnson, and I'm a family doctor from Wasilla. I'm the medical director for the Children's Place, which is the Child Advocacy Center in Wasilla, as well as the medical director for Alaska Cares, which is the Child Advocacy Center in Anchorage. And I'm here as the chair of the Alaska Children's Justice Act Task Force.
And I am Pam Carolunas, the statewide coordinator of the Alaska Children's Alliance, and I will be talking about that a little more during our presentation.
And I'm Jared Parrish with the Maternal and Child Health Epidemiology Unit with the Alaska Division of Public Health. I'm an epidemiologist studying child maltreatment.
Thank you. And then what I'd like to do, because this is a joint session, I'd like to pass the gavel to Senator Davis, who is chair of the Senate HES Committee. And we will proceed, and they just introduced themselves, and I thank right. Everybody on the record as being here, and so you just go right on ahead.
All right, thank you. Right.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Madam. Just an introduction to the task force. We have a number of the task force members that are with us today, and I was just going to ask those members that are here today to go ahead and stand, so you'll know who else is here. The task force was founded in 1999. It is a federally mandated and federally funded in order to evaluate our system's response here in Alaska to allegations of child maltreatment, especially child sexual abuse and serious child physical abuse. In addition to making evaluations, we're also supposed to make recommendations for how the system can be improved to make children safer. We have multidisciplinary and statewide representation. And in addition to our recommendations, we also undertake various projects, and we'll give you an update on some of those projects today. One of our projects is usually to do an annual report to the legislature, and in the past that has been to the Children's Caucus. And so we really appreciate the opportunity to have a little larger venue to give our message to this time. We do have a handout for you that has all of our membership list, as well as our contact information, because we're absolutely willing to always be a resource to you. Today, we'll give you some updates on some various projects, as well as updates of the status of child advocacy centers here in Alaska. Jared is going to give you an update on current data on child maltreatment in Alaska. And then we're going to talk a little bit about some of the gaps that we've seen in our system response and some of our recommendations for you for this upcoming year. One of our updates is on the Pathway to Hope initiative. And a couple of years ago, some of you may have seen a presentation that we did. This was a basically an Alaska Native initiative in responding to the high rates of child sexual abuse, especially in rural Alaska, with a focus really on ending the silence. The Children's Justice Act Task Force provided some of the funding for the inaugural training, which was held in Anchorage in 2008. And since that time, there have been actually over 200 community facilitators trained on Pathway to Hope all over Alaska, and this has actually reached communities down, tribal communities down in the lower 48. There are ongoing requests for continued training, and so as long as there are various pots of funding that can help support that, this is a training that is not only reaching groups here in Alaska, but all over the country. A couple of the outgrowths of that are there have been ongoing monthly teleconferences that do receive some outside funding, so that all the folks that are graduates can continue to keep in touch and keep each other educated about child maltreatment issues. And another recent outgrowth was a conference that was held in Kodiak in November of 2009 called Honoring Our Children. And there are a number of trainings planned for this upcoming year. So it's a very exciting ongoing response here in the state and elsewhere. Some of our other projects, a number of years ago, we developed a training CD to help teach people who are mandated reporters about, you know, what is a mandated reporter and how do you report and what does that mean when you make a report, in addition to placing that on our website so that anybody can have access to that. And continuing to print and distribute that CD, we've now printed and distributed thousands of these all over Alaska. We've had requests from other states, and we've actually had requests for the CD from other countries, so it's definitely getting out there. We developed a teaching curriculum that can be used. So folks can use this CD, they can go through the training by themselves on our website, or if somebody wants to have actually provide a class on this at their school or in their agency, then we've got a teaching curriculum that accompanies that. We've continued to provide scholarships for Alaskan professionals that are working in the field of child maltreatment. We have started working on a multidisciplinary team best practices guidelines handbook to help those folks that are out in the field that may not run into these kind of cases very often. And we also sponsored a statewide child forensic interviewing forum. And I'm going to talk just a little bit about that. Talking to kids about difficult things is really challenging, and it's really a challenge in this state to try to make sure that everybody who's going to be talking to kids about things like sexual abuse or serious physical abuse have the special skills that they need and know how to talk to kids to be able to get the best information. Not only to be able to protect the child better and to allow the child to be able to tell their story, but also to have the best evidence for a case that should be prosecuted. So one of the things that this statewide forum did was to look at some of the advantages and disadvantages of some of the different models that are out there for forensic interviewing, and to list out some of the advantages and disadvantages for each, especially in Alaska. And they talked about some of the challenges that we face in Alaska. Some of those have to do with diversity, and certainly geography is a big challenge that we face, and some of the resource issues that we face, especially in the really remote parts of the state. They made some recommendations that we have looked at. One had to do with the essential components that should be present in any kind of training, both in basic training as well as in advanced forensic training. And then there was a recommendation to do some kind of basic field guide or protocol. So that's one of the things that we're incorporating into our multidisciplinary guidelines book that we're working on right now. Now I'd like to turn things over to Pam to talk about the Alaska Children's Alliance. For those of you who don't know, child advocacy centers are based on a national model for all of the different folks that are involved with evaluating allegations of child maltreatment come together to bring all their services and resources to the child, so the child doesn't have to go from place to place to place and tell their story multiple times.
Correct. And again, thank you for the opportunity to present here today. The Alaska Children's Alliance is a state chapter of a national organization, and our mission is to promote a culturally appropriate multidisciplinary response to child maltreatment throughout Alaska. And Kathy talked about the multidisciplinary response and what that means. The national organization does a number of important things for us. They set minimum standards for the CACs as well as for the state chapters. They provide some limited funding for the chapters, support and training and technical assistance, research on current best practices, just any number of you know, valuable trainings that they and opportunities that they offer. The national recognition and accreditation, which is really important. And that's what we're going, what I'm going to be talking about a little bit here too. The state chapter also provides training and technical assistance to existing child advocacy centers, to developing child advocacy centers, to multidisciplinary teams and child protection teams in areas that are wanting to focus on responding to child maltreatment. We also offer training and technical assistance to state and local organizations and agencies. We're here to be a resource for folks like you or, you know, across the board. We also represent the state on the regional level and the national level. We provide limited funding to the CACs through national grants and coordination of statewide efforts, which includes coordinating training and includes working on data collection because we realize how very important that is, and on developing statewide protocols. There are 9 children's advocacy centers in the state, and they're listed there, and 1 developing child advocacy center in Kodiak. I would strongly encourage you, I know many of you have toured the CAC Child Advocacy Center in your community. If you haven't had the opportunity to do that, I would strongly encourage you to do that, to get a sense of what it is that they do. The next slides, I'm going to be talking about some of the national standards, and you'll notice at the bottom of some of these slides are comments. These are all direct comments, direct quotes taken from children or parents seen at our Child Advocacy Center. One of the main standards, as Kathy referred to, is a child and family-friendly environment where everyone can come together rather than having the child go from place to place to place to be interviewed multiple times by some people that may or may not be trained in forensic interviewing of children. There is a specialized forensic interview. There's training that goes along with that. Here we have pictures of 2 separate interview rooms. The interviews are videotaped. And rather than having multiple people ask the children multiple questions or interview them multiple times, one person does the forensic interview and the others watch through a closed circuit monitor so that they can make sure that all of their questions get asked and answered. And the child knows about this. They're very aware of what's happening. We also provide a specialized non-traumatic medical exam. You may be a little surprised to see that comment up there from a child. That tells you about the value of the medical exam and the kind of medical exam. It's different from what you see in an adult sexual assault exam, because child sexual abuse certainly has some differences from adult sexual assault. Mental health services are a very significant part for the children and families that have experienced this kind of trauma. And so all of our CACs either have a mental health provider on site, or they work very collaboratively with existing mental health providers in their community to ensure that child and families get an earlier response. Culturally competent care, of course, is very significant and very important to make the children and families feel comfortable, whatever their culture and background may be. And so that includes identification of the risks and assessments of the needs and then appropriate referrals. One of the things that hasn't changed in the 20-some years I've been doing this is the research that says that the support and belief of the non-offending caregiver is very key in the long-term outcome for the child. And what we know is in order to do that, we need to provide support and information and ongoing advocacy to the non-offending caregiver and the family. And so that's another important standard that's expected for CACs. We also do case review and case tracking. We have an amazing data collection system that's actually required for all of our CACs that are state-funded to track data so that we can give information to funding sources and to our communities and to our state. It also helps us take a look at how the system is working in our individual communities and identify the strengths and what's going well, and maybe look at areas where we need to reassess how we're handling those cases. CACs also provide community awareness, presentations, classes, radio shows, interviews, et cetera, so that we can get information out there for the community about child abuse and child sexual abuse. People often wonder about these kids that are seen at CACs, and so I just have a couple of slides up here about that. About 30% of the kids that are seen at child advocacy centers are boys, and this is for FY09, but that's pretty much, you know, a constant. That doesn't change a lot. And 41% of the kids seen at CACs are ages 6 and under. There's some research that has been done and some research that is continuing to be done on the use of CACs and the value of the model. And some research that was recently completed talked about some of the benefits of the use of CACs. They measured communities that are using CACs versus communities that weren't using CACs. And as you can see, there are some significant benefits, particularly for the families and the children in those communities that actually have child advocacy centers. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but I do think it's interesting that of the 9 CACs in existence, we serve 209 different communities throughout the state, and that since the first CAC opened in Anchorage in 1996, over 12,700 children have received services through the child advocacy centers. And next to talk to us a little bit more about very interesting data is Jared Parrish.
Great. Thank you, Pam. I'm very grateful to be here before you to share some of this information that I look at daily and that now you can see some of this information too. Really, I'm giving you a briefing and a broad brushstroke of fatal maltreatment that's occurring in the state of Alaska. And if you want further information, you can contact me and it can be provided to you in more detail so that the information can be more fully elaborated upon. I am with the Alaska SCAN program, which is the Surveillance of Child Abuse and Neglect in Alaska. So we're applying a public health model, which I'll give a brief explanation of what that means. And so I'm housed within the Women's, Children's, and Family Health section of the Alaska Division of Public Health. So why is public health involved in child maltreatment? I get asked that question daily as an epidemiologist when I should be studying things like the flu. I'm going to be referring child maltreatment as CM on the slides up here so that you guys, when you see that, you recognize what that is. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recognizes child maltreatment as a serious public health problem, as a serious health problem, with extensive short and long-term health consequences, such as drug and alcohol abuse, suicidal and mental health problems, teenage pregnancy, obesity, and other health problems. When I read this, I always need to change the definition a little bit, is that this isn't another public health problem. It's the public's health problem. And as I review the data, I often look at how we can mold the data into helping the public understand that. So when I look at public health surveillance, when I first got into this, I didn't realize that no single agency has jurisdictional responsibility for all child maltreatment. I pretty much thought that the Child Protective Services within the state was responsible for everything. But because that is not true, no single agency has all the information about child maltreatment in our state. Public health comes into place where we try to bring all that information together into one place. So if you look at the puzzle pieces on the slide, each agency is represented by one piece of the puzzle that has information appropriate to their agency. With our public health surveillance, we tried to bring that information together, apply a standardized definition that is extremely sensitive. We look at this as an issue where we don't want to miss a case. We want to be able to count all maltreatment. So we apply a definition that looks at confirmed cases, related cases, and suspected cases. And these are all based on level of evidence. By doing this, we can measure the true magnitude over time. We can really see what's going on, the impact to our society, and we can identify high-risk populations by having this type of information. So Alaska Scan, what we do is we are funded by the Title V Maternal and Child Health Block Grant. So this is federally funded. And I did come up here as a CDC person, and because of the great work and the people that I get to work with, I decided to stay. And the state's doing amazing work up here on this, and this is a perfect example because this is the only state really that's doing this much work towards it. What we do is we collect data from multiple sources, we bring them together, and we collect both death and injury data. Today I am sharing death data because it is the most extreme consequence or outcome, and we should do something to avoid those. So I want to give you a couple of examples on what these high sensitivity definitions are. This is Baby Albert. This is based on national data with some other states that do very similar things. Baby Albert was a four-month-old baby boy born drug exposed, was sleeping on the couch with mom and dad, found at 2 a.m. not breathing. The emergency medical services responded, found both parents intoxicated and drug paraphernalia. The parents had an 8-year child protective service history on both parents. The rights were terminated on four of their children, and the mother lost two children in a fire when a drug deal went bad and the house was firebombed. So what was the outcome here? Well, the death certificate said that this was a natural death due to SIDS. The Child Protective Services in that state said it was abuse due to suffocation. The Child Death Review Team, which reviews the deaths, said accidental suffocation. And the CDC project, which is equivalent to SCAN, the Surveillance of Child Abuse and Neglect here, said accidental suffocation, neglect is the underlying cause. Another case, to provide another look at this, is that there was a 2-year-old toddler riding with the father when hit by another car. The other driver was at fault in the crash, but the father admitted to drinking 4 beers before driving, had a blood alcohol content at the crash of 0.07. Heather was in the back car seat, but the seat was not buckled in. She was thrown from the car, and upon impact, the death was caused by multiple head injuries. And what does this look like? The death certificate said accidental motor vehicle accident. The Child Protective Service, it wasn't reported to them. The Child Death Review Team labeled this as motor vehicle, and the CDC project, which again is equivalent to SCAN, said that yes, this was due to neglect by the father because they failed to buckle the seat properly due to alcohol use. So from a public health perspective, where we're not bound by definitions to prove without a doubt or to prove or substantiate, we can be very sensitive where there's underlying circumstances that have gross negligence, neglect, or abuse. So when we apply this very highly sensitive definition, what does it look like, or how does it change the numbers in our state? When we look at the source years from 1992 through 2005 at the all infant deaths that occurred in the state of Alaska, if we use only those deaths obtained from the death certificate as labeled as homicide or have an ICD coding that indicates child maltreatment, we would count 22 deaths during this time frame. If we include the related cases, which is extracted mainly from the Maternal Infant Mortality Review, Child Death Review Team in our state, that number increases to 74. And here we're starting to pick up a lot of the neglect cases that are missed when we just look at vital statistics. And then when we incorporate the full sensitivity of the Alaska SCAN definition, our number jumps up to 133 cases. And these are 133 cases that have been identified as child maltreatment related and that could have been prevented. These are, when you look at the breakdown, is 35% abuse and 65% neglect. Now, this is not different statistically than any other state. The other states that have implemented this type of sensitive definitions have found almost the identical breakdowns and missed cases. And a few states that are like this is Michigan, Missouri, and Rhode Island. So we're right in line with missing detection and then being able to find it. So when we look at trends, because we're dealing with fatalities or death here, we have low numbers. So we break down our population into major groups. And here we compare the Alaska Native and the Alaska non-Native populations. And you can see, without a doubt, there is a difference between the two trends where Alaska Native populations have higher infant mortality due to child maltreatment through all years examined. Hopefully I can shed some light, though, on the silver lining behind what we can do behind that. When we look at children aged 0 to 9 years in Alaska from 2000 to 2006, we find that using our sensitive definition, 22% of all those deaths were child maltreatment related. Among the Alaska Native population, this number increases to 25% and decreases to 20% for a non-Native population in Alaska. And those numbers are statistically different between those two populations. When we compare the rate per 10,000 child population, so oftentimes people refer to this as per capita or different ways that way, so we compare different populations. The Alaska Native population is 4 times increased risk of having a child maltreatment related death. A substantially higher rate. So a few numbers to describe who is at risk of maltreatment related death. Now I'm just going to give a real brief broad stroke on this because as epidemiologists I do a lot of investigations on what are risk factors or associated factors with maltreatment. And oftentimes we really want to identify subpopulations so that we can be fiscally responsible with the resources that we're given so we can target interventions directly to the people who mostly need it. When we break out the Alaska Native mothers and the Alaska non-Native factors and look at risk factors, what we find when we look at the two risk factors through this one study is that only one risk factor is the same. And what that tells us as researchers is that our populations are different, so therefore we need to target different people. We can't use a one-size-fits-all approach and target the exact same people. This really, really helps with prevention efforts for us to focus our resources that are given to us so that we can make better decisions. So now, maltreatment encompasses abuse, neglect, gross negligence, and so we always want to break those out and what are the differences between neglect and abuse in our state. Through the years 2000 to 2006, for those aged 0 to 9 years, Alaska Scan identified 135 cases of maltreatment-related deaths. 40% is the proportion of abuse-related deaths where substance abuse was identified as a direct contributor to the death. 63% is the proportion of maltreatment-related deaths due to neglect. So we have a high proportion of our maltreatment-related deaths due to neglect, which has implications of where public health can become directly involved. And here is was one of the interesting findings that I found is that Alaska Native population have a 5-time increased risk of having a neglect-related maltreatment death than when compared to Alaska non-Natives. So there was a striking difference in the neglect-related deaths, which actually has very good implications for public health because these are types of issues that can be prevented through public health messages and can be under the umbrella of positive parenting or other types of messaging. And 95% is the proportion of Alaska Native among Alaska Native neglect-related deaths among those aged 1 to 9 where it was due to lack of age-appropriate supervision. So again, a lot of education that can be employed there. And now a quick look at the...
Just one moment, please.
Yes.
I'd like to invite Senator Bernard and Senator Thomas to come up and join us. There's a couple chairs here.
We were late. We didn't want to draw to our attention.
It's quite all right. You may continue.
Thank you. Now I'll share with you some regional distributions of maltreatment-related infant death that we can look at. And this is the regional comparisons of fatal child maltreatment-related infant death per 1,000 live births in Alaska for the years 2000 to 2006. when we look at Anchorage compared to all other rural regions in the state, there's a 50% increased risk in child maltreatment-related infant death in the rural regions compared to Alaska. I mean, to Anchorage, sorry. Within Anchorage, 3 in 16 infant deaths were child maltreatment-related. Within the rural regions, 2 out of 9 infant deaths were child maltreatment-related. Anchorage alone accounted for 41% of all child maltreatment-related deaths. Now, when we do comparisons, we generally pick one region and we compare with those other regions. So I'm going to compare all regions to Anchorage now. When we compared Anchorage with the interior regions, we found no significant difference in child maltreatment-related infant death rates. Within the interior, we found that out of all the deaths out of all infant deaths in the interior, nearly 1 in 4 infant deaths were related to child maltreatment. And this accounted to 17% of all child maltreatment-related deaths in the state. The Southwest, we found no significant difference between child maltreatment-related infant death rates and Anchorage. Within the Southwest, however, nearly 1 out of 8 infant deaths were child maltreatment-related, and this accounted for 9% of all infant child maltreatment-related deaths in the state. The Gulf Coast, again, there was no significant difference in infant death rate due to child maltreatment when compared to Anchorage. There are slight increases in risk, and that's why when we combine all the rural areas, there was a significant difference between the two. When we look at the Gulf Coast, nearly 2 out of 9 infant deaths were child maltreatment related, and this accounted to 10% of all infant child maltreatment related deaths in the state. The Southeast, again, no significant difference in child maltreatment-related deaths when compared to Anchorage with the death rate. And in the Southeast, nearly 2 out of 7 infant deaths were child maltreatment-related, and this accounted for 10% of all infant child maltreatment-related deaths. Now, the Northern region, however, did have a statistical difference in child maltreatment-related infant death rates, and it was nearly 3 times higher. This equated to, in the Northern region, nearly 3 out of 10 infant deaths were child maltreatment-related, and it accounted for 13% of all infant child maltreatment-related deaths in the state. Now, because this was a briefing and a brushstroke, I'm just going to provide you some of the take-home points from the data that I found. With the WHO, there are independent associated factors that uniquely differ between Alaska Native and non-Native populations. The implications of this is that we can correctly target public health prevention programs directed at evidence-based high-risk populations, so we can be fiscally responsible with the resources that are given to us and measure impact with what we're doing with those resources. Alaska Native infants do have higher maltreatment-related mortality rates relative to non-natives for all years examined. However, neglect-related deaths account for much of this disparity. So if we focus on neglect-related deaths, we will have the largest impact on reducing maltreatment-related deaths. And this is most suited for public health intervention because we can do risk reduction strategies, which are relatively cheap, and community empowerment can take place. And where relative to Anchorage, Mat-Su region, the rural regions have significantly higher infant child maltreatment-related rates. There is a strong need for innovative child maltreatment prevention programs in rural Alaska. The programs that currently exist for prevention really aren't suited well for the geography and the rural Alaska regions. So we need to be innovative and think of some new approaches to this issue. And finally, why is SCAN critical to public health child maltreatment prevention? I like to reiterate this point, is the application of data to prevent maltreatment. When we can target high-risk populations, we can use our resources effectively. We can identify the types of maltreatment that we need to be focusing on. If a mother's more likely to neglect her parent, we're providing her physical abuse prevention messages, we're not going to prevent neglect-related death. So we need to be able to focus our messages. And we can measure impact over time and provide evaluative support here in the state. In the past, to evaluate our programs, we've had to go out of state. But now we can do this in-house here and use our own data. And also, it's really important so that we can help reduce the burden of child maltreatment of going to servicing agencies like Office of Children's Services and law enforcement. Just for example, in SFY 2009, OCS had 13,441 reports of harm to OCS. This equates to nearly 7 reports per 1 work hour, a huge burden of work. And APD in 2009, the Crimes Against Children Unit reviewed 483 reports of sexual abuse of minors, or approximately 40 per month. So there's this huge burden that they're faced with. And so now Kathy is going to finish up here with what kids need from us. Thank you.
Thank you. We felt the timing was really good because right now we have administrative support with the Governor Parnell's Choose Respect initiative, which is intended to address sexual assault and domestic violence here in Alaska, and includes plans to improve the process for investigation and prosecution, do a better job of protecting victims, strengthening our shelters, and includes a public education campaign. But the CJ Task Force did take a look at this initiative, and we talked about some of the elements that might be missing for kids. Some of the overall elements are that we really do have a need for more and better data. A lot of the data, the studies that have been used to craft the initiative have to do really do leave kids out, because a lot of the child sexual abuse cases don't get reported to those same data banks that they were using. Child victims are often handled differently. Sometimes law enforcement doesn't realize that they can use domestic violence laws for child victims. There's been an inconsistent application of the statute that we have that basically mandates the uses of CACs or child advocacy centers wherever possible. And there's inconsistencies in response of the system, everywhere from the initial response to sentencing in the state. Mm-hmm. Some other gaps that we've noticed have to do with the need for an improved statewide training curriculum for forensic interviewing of children, and a way to be able to do peer review of forensic interviewing. And peer review, both for healthcare providers and for other practitioners, is really important in order to improve practice and try to meet standards. And indeed, the National Children's Alliance now has as a requirement for accreditation that the child advocacy centers be able to do peer review of forensic interviews. And we don't have any ability really to maintain confidentiality of that process in our state right now. In addition, under the medical care of children, we need right now, the way our laws are written, it's all well and good to do peer review within a hospital setting, but really, it's a little bit fuzzy when we're trying to do peer review across the state within child advocacy centers. The other thing that we've seen a need for is a child-friendly forensic evidence kit. Right now, when we do have a child that's been sexually assaulted and we pull out this big, scary package, that it adds to the trauma for kids. And there are other states that have developed really nice models for pediatric evidence kits. And then finally, one of the gaps that we've seen are our current child assault-related laws. And I'd like to give you some examples from children seen at our child advocacy centers here in the state. And I want to caution you, we've included some photos, and they're hard to look at, but I think it's really important that you can see what it is that that we're concerned about here. This was an 8-year-old little girl whose dad grabbed her by the neck so that she couldn't breathe or speak. He slammed her against the wall and threw her to the floor and punched her. She did have findings on her exam that were consistent with strangulation. So she had marks on her neck, and she had all these little ruptured blood vessels on her face that went with strangulation. In this case, however, it was not charged as a strangulation. It was charged as felony assault, but it was pled down to a misdemeanor. And the perpetrator received 270 days, but 135 days of that were suspended. This was a 7-year-old, that child that was seen, who was beaten with a belt by his dad after the principal called home because of some minor trouble the boy had gotten into at school. The little boy estimated that he'd been hit somewhere between 20 and 30 times. We counted at least that many impact points on this child's buttocks and back and legs. It was enough where it broke the skin. We did some blood work on this child, and he was actually mildly anemic, which means that he had had a fair amount of blood loss from this beating into his buttocks and legs. And the district attorney's office in this case really felt like their hands were tied, and there was no way with our current assault laws for this to be charged as a felony, so it was charged as a misdemeanor. This was a four-year-old that was seen, I think, 5 days after being hit and bit by mom's boyfriend. This child, even 5 days later, still had bruising marks on his face and still had a lot of bruising of his ears where his ears had been boxed, and he still had healing puncture wounds from the bite and bruises on his arm from the bite. He was sentenced to, the perpetrator was sentenced to 24 months, of which 20 months of that was suspended. This was a three-year-old whose dad got frustrated with her because she couldn't say her ABCs correctly, at which point he burned her 7 different times with a cigarette lighter. This was charged and pled as a misdemeanor. And if you think about the amount of time that it took to repeatedly light that cigarette lighter and heat it back up and burn this child's ankle, foot, and leg, this actually really should have constituted torture. But again, with the way our laws are currently written, it was felt that this really had to be charged as a misdemeanor, and her dad received a sentence of 20 days. This was a one-year-old who was left in dad's care while mom went to the store. Mom came back and found her baby gravely injured. He had a fractured femur, which is that large bone that's in the upper leg. He had hanger marks on his back. He had an injury to his liver. He had significant bruising on both sides of his face, and he had ruptured blood vessels and marks on his neck that that were consistent with strangulation. This was charged as an assault because of the broken leg. That ups the ante to being a serious enough injury that requires medical care, and therefore this could be charged as a felony assault. However, the plea agreement is for a year. This was a one-year-old. And then in several of the child advocacy centers, we've had reports of infants that have been witnessed to have been shaken. And unfortunately, by the time reports were made and these children were being evaluated, we were seeing these babies weeks to months later. And at that point, there were no residual findings on these children. We don't know what kind of injuries they might have sustained at the time and what the long-term impact of those might be. But because there were no residual findings, no way to prove anything, this infant can't tell us that they were frightened for their life when they were being shaken. There are actually no charges able to be filed in these cases. And I just wanted to compare a couple of things. This is from the Anchorage Daily News. Anchorage man who beat his dog with a rifle, knocking out many of the dog's teeth. He pled no contest to animal cruelty, was sentenced to 360 days, 60 of those were suspended. So he actually is serving less than a year in jail and serving less time than the perpetrators of all of these other crimes against children. And this was another case with an Anchorage man who was going to end up serving 8 years in prison for killing his grandfather's dog. And of those, a year of that was for animal cruelty. So what's going on with our laws? It's just that the way that they're written right now, kids are put right in with adult assault laws. I just use this as an example, third degree felony assault, which places means you have to place another person in fear of imminent serious physical injury by means of a dangerous instrument, or cause physical injury by means of a dangerous instrument. Well, for children, a dangerous instrument can be a fist or a belt or a hanger, whereas it may not be, you know, for an adult. The statute also says, when it talks about children, that it's only for children under the age of 10, and the injury has to cause a reasonable caregiver to seek medical treatment in the form of diagnosis or treatment, or medical attention in the form of diagnosis or treatment. Well, the problem with that is it's very limiting. So those cigarette burns on that three-year-old who couldn't say her ABCs, those were burns that were going to heal probably regardless of any sort of medical intervention that child had. And so our prosecutor's hands are really tied with the way things are written right now. So what do we need to do? I really think the timing is right for change. We have an administration that's friendly to this concept, and we have, I think, a number of you that are willing to be a voice for children. We have to be the voice for children because they're not able to be here to speak for themselves. So there's some very specific things we wanted to ask for some help. One has to do with funding. But the good news is that these are things that are already in the budget, so this isn't something new. One is ongoing funding for child advocacy centers, which are currently in the DHSS section of the budget. The one proviso we wanted to say is that that funding that's in the budget right now is just for existing CACs. So there's not an ability right now for more state funding for new and developing child advocacy centers. Another thing that's already in the budget under the Department of Public Safety is to bring the Child First forensic interview training curriculum to Alaska. This is a highly respected, very well-established interviewing curriculum that actually different CACs have brought to use just within their communities in the state. And we would have an opportunity to bring this to the whole state and train trainers so that this would allow for everyone who needs this training in the state to be trained to it. And it would remove some of the burden from OCS, which right now has to do all the forensic interview training for anybody who wants it. And then the other thing we need that's also currently proposed in the budget is just a little pocket of money to develop a child forensic evidence kit. And the good news is this is actually a community effort, and we actually have an artist who is willing to donate the art and graphics for this kit as long as this funding is procured to go forward. And there's some statutory things that we would ask you to look at. One is to clarify the requirement to use CACs wherever possible to include law enforcement and not just the Office of Children's Services. We'd like to have clarified the medical peer review confidentiality to include medical professionals who work in child advocacy centers. We need a way for people who do forensic interviews of children to be able to have a confidential peer review process. And we would ask to have an evaluation of those gaps in our current assault laws relating to children and really consider separate crimes against children statutes. Many states in the country have very successfully done that. So we're asking you to be a champion for children in Alaska. And this is what the task force is going to do. We're planning to complete our best practice guidelines for multidisciplinary teams. We'll be sponsoring the Alaska Child Maltreatment Conference, which will be held in November of this year. We'll be assisting with the development and providing some advice for the development of this child forensic evidence kit. And we are absolutely willing to be a resource to all of you. So. And unfortunately, the world is a dangerous place for some of our children right now, and we're just asking for some assistance to do something about that. And we'd like to give some time for some questions as well, so thank you very much.
That completes your presentation?
Yes, ma'am.
Before we ask for questions, do we have all the material that you just provided us about the things you'd like to see happen and what you plan to do? Because I don't see that in my package.
We can.
I just want to know if they're here. If not, we need to have them.
We will absolutely provide those for you, Chair.
I didn't see your information, the person that spoke from Public Health. Did you provide that to us?
Madam Chair, those will be provided to you through the slides.
Okay. Yes. Thank you very much. All right. I know probably you have some questions or comments. I'm going to first call on Senator Dyson, since he has been having the report given to the Children's Caucus in the past, and he's sharing it with more agents, divisions now. Let him speak first.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I need to excuse myself here. I have another appointment. my sense is that you're exactly on track on going through and rewriting the laws and separating the children's assaults against children statutes and so on. Do you have the resources to be able to do that work and present it to the legislature for implementation? Do you have legal researchers that are going to do that?
No, we do not. We do have some legal representation on the task force, but and there are some recommendations, and we've looked at some
models and ideas from a couple of other states, but that's something we would definitely need assistance with.
And if, just follow up, I suspect this administration is quite sympathetic. And have you talked with the governor's team or the Department of Law about doing that work for you?
Not yet.
No. All right. All right. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Any other comments yet?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. It was striking when you talked about the court and the sentences being suspended so often and so much. I wonder what the court rationale is for suspending these sentences to something that it approaches the ridiculous, or maybe even gets there. And you have any suggestion for any kind of statute that would address this, reducing the or suspending the sentences at all?
You know, part of it may be a need for some changes in the law, and part of it may be a need for more education for judges about the serious consequences, as Jared was alluding to, this very, very serious long-term consequences of child maltreatment. These are very difficult cases because children, a lot of times, you know, a three-year-old is a very challenging witness in court. And so these are very difficult cases to prosecute.
Well, just a comment. It's difficult to educate anybody on almost anything, especially issues like this, and maybe especially judges. Thank you.
That completes your comment?
I have more, but I think I better stop there at least momentarily.
All right. We have other people that do want to speak. I don't know the order that you're going to be asking your questions, but I'm going to call on Rep. What's your last name?
Heron.
Heron. That's right. Heron. I should remember. Co-chair Heron.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to thank you very much to you and the task force for the work that you do for our children. And obviously, a very sad story on this syndemic that we have in our society. I mean, maltreatment is because of so many other things, and so you can't. It's not an epidemic. It's not sudden. It's not recent. It's just so ingrained in our society. So, thank you very much. I guess a couple of questions. One is that I appreciate the review of what the judicial system has to go through, and those awful statistics that you brought up. But you said earlier in your presentation about inconsistent application of use of statute 47.17.033. Could you please give one or two examples?
The way that statute was written, it has been interpreted as applying only to OCS using the child advocacy centers. So what we see happening around the state is, you know, law enforcement may make the decision for very good reasons, particularly from their perspective, that they are going to not use the CAC. So we all have, you know, horror stories of someone who hasn't been trained in forensic interviewing of children, doing an interview that is only partially recorded or not recorded, or the recording doesn't work and it's only audio recorded. The one case recently where the child was interviewed with, you know, the mom in the room, the siblings in the room, you know, people going in and out, you know, that's not a forensic interview. You know, those kinds of examples happen almost daily. And again, it's because of what ended up, you know, where the statute ended up getting placed, and the determination has been made that that only applies to OCS.
Thank you, Madam. One more.
You may continue.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess is that, you know, obviously the governor's come out with his initiative. My view of it at first blush was great on lock them up and throw them away, but not much on prevention and treatment. And so I'm starting to, my view is starting to change. So I, you know, the work that you've done can, and continue to do, can help the legislature. Every one of us in some way is going to have a chance to affect laws that the governor's promoting and the legislature wants to do to protect our children. So please, I can only say on behalf of the children that your ideas are probably better than a lot of our ideas, because you're much more closer to the issue. And so thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I find it incredible with what you showed, that the dog, the person that beat their dog got a longer sentence than the child. And regardless of whether the child makes a good witness or not, exposure must be a witness to the, obviously, the beating of the dog, but the dog certainly would not be so good as a child. So I'm not sure if I quite understand that very well. But just the idea that regardless, obviously the case went to court, it was reviewed, there were charges filed. But it seems to me that the sentence was not at all what could have been the maximum, especially with the suspension, the amount of suspension. So that'll find out. But I guess what I started to think about is the governor does have an initiative. I would think that as well as putting forth the initiative, that would have requested some kind of legislation be introduced. So time is short for increasing personal bills. It might be your advantage to go back to the governor and suggest that they make their own suggestions, which will help those things to change. They certainly have to access the laws that should be changed. But in the earlier subject matter, and I apologize for being late, we don't have to substantiate most of what you've already done again. So I think the point is, you know, the intervention of what takes place. So your suggestions are great, I think. But he didn't see the suggestions of how we intervene other than the idea of a more benign kit for determining child molestation or sexual conduct or something like that. And I think maybe your suggestions, unless there's more in the packet I haven't seen, should be more too, what intervention takes place, what should be done, as well as the laws changed to be harder on the prosecution. I agree that we certainly need to try and work with people to get through things. I think we all, as we look at domestic violence and other crimes like that, they usually don't subside, they only get worse, is what it amounts to. That's generally what I've heard testimony to. But people have to be taken out of those situations, or else it's just a second or a third opportunity for somebody to beat or molest or abuse.
I'll take that more as a comment and not necessarily that you have to give an answer to me. It was not really a question. If you have a comment to make concerning what he said, that's fine. Otherwise, we could go to the next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess the one comment that I would make is that one of the responses that we talked about are child advocacy centers in Alaska, which I think are a proven, a very effective way to intervene and provide support and services to children and their families. And we will provide a copy of our PowerPoint. As you all know, PowerPoint is something that you can fiddle with till the last minute to try to make it better. And so we were certainly doing that, and we will be happy to provide you with a copy afterwards.
Thank you. Well, once again, we are very pleased that you were able to come before us and give your report. We know the importance of it, and everybody's still in place, so you can understand that we got a lot out of it. Otherwise, we'd be gone. We'd be everywhere else. Do you have a comment to make?
Yes. I just want to say thank you again.
Seth Kelly.
Yeah, and invite you to continue to distill out specifics like that we can do, because that really helps us in figure out just exactly how to approach the whole problem. And I also want to echo your invitation to visit a CAC, a child advocacy center. I've been to the Children's Place and one in Anchorage, and it does give you a perspective that is really helpful. So I would commend that. The other one is just a clarification. You said that the
money, there's some operating money in there for the existing CACs, but, and then you talked about the Child First interview training curriculum and the forensic evidence kits. Are those on the budget? I just missed it. There's several of us on that committee we can watch for, but all that is on this year's governor's budget.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. I just didn't quite pick up if you said it was or it wasn't, and I just wanted to find out. Thank you.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I visited with the Child Advocacy Center down in Homer, had a number of conversations there. I know that the local police are utilizing it exclusively. Have great things to say about the information that they receive and that they can call in if the question isn't asked that they need answered for their information, and then the interviewer, without having to leave the room or disturb, can go ahead and ask those questions. However, the my understanding was that the troopers, public safety, there seems to be more of a problem there than with local police, and I don't know how much of that is remote access when you're out in some place where there's not a child advocacy center. We don't want to have a thing where you can't have an interview until you take a child out of their situation and fly them into a regional hub or something. So I'm not sure whenever possible goes. And I did talk to the Commissioner of Public Safety about a policy and working within the department to say that, you know, what those guidelines would be. Have you worked with the commissioner recently to see if there is policy development that would stimulate the individual officers across the state to utilize those, and under what conditions that they would be able to conduct the interviews where there might be more loss than gained by the delay in taking a child out of let's say a rural community.
We've not had conversations with the commissioner at this point. We have had some conversations with other folks within the Department of Public Safety. And as you said, sometimes it can be a matter of resources, because it can be expensive to fly a child in. It's important, I think, to understand that the Child Advocacy Center offers not only a place for a forensic interview, but also the ability for that child to have a specialized medical exam, and also to get hooked up with resources. That probably is, you know, more important than anything else that we do in the long run for that child and family, to get the support and assistance that they need. But as Pam said, sometimes there are very good reasons why children aren't being brought in that have to do with the lack of resources. And so that is one of the things that we've been looking at, are there alternate ways to pay for children to come in for forensic interviews and medical exams, so that it's not such a burden on law enforcement or the Office of Children's Services. So that is something that we've been investigating.
Okay. Follow up, Madam Chair?
Yes, you may.
Thank you. And I guess my concern is that, you know, before the exam would take place, a determination has to be made then to remove the child from their home, basically, and for maybe an extended period of time. And I don't know, you know, how all of those come forward. So I would really request that you meet with the commissioner, because he was very open to a policy solution so that they could get those without the limitations that might occur if we just pass a red line statute that says this is what happens, and then how to work with in those. And so appreciate the chair's indulgence on the second comment here.
No problem. And I
do encourage you to have a meeting, and if you need help, I'm sure any of us would be very pleased to help facilitate that meeting, and I would as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Well, if there's no other comment from the committee, that completes your presentation, and we could turn it back over to Rep. Kelly so he can go and discharge this meeting so he can go on with his regular meeting. Is Is there anyone in the audience that was supposed to say anything? No? Nobody from the Department of Health and Social Service? Or okay. Back to you.
Being here at 4:20 in the House S Committee, and present is Representative Bob Lynn and Representative Paul Seaton and Representative Bob Heron, Tammy Wilson, and Representative Holmes will be back here shortly. Yeah, she's stepped out for a moment. On the schedule today was SB 101. We're not going to make it. We got 40 minutes, so what we'll try our best to reschedule SB 101. That's the one on questionnaires next Tuesday, and that way it'll be on the schedule, be clearly heard and all that, and that way we'll just proceed today with HB 89. Otherwise, we're just compressing it too much. Okay, great. Thank you. So with that, we have HB 89 before us, and it's a law related to the rehab, Volk Rehab Committee, and it brings the, I guess, our statutes into line with what the feds are doing, and the committee is, the idea is they promote rehab and employment for disabled folks, and so we'll welcome you up here, and if you would, introduce yourselves for the record, and tell us what HB 89 does. And the working document in front of us is what? Representative Heron, do you have it right there in front of you? Just so we make sure we're all on the same bill.
Yes, sir. Do you want a motion to adopt this? Yes.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Mr. Co-Chair, I move that we adopt CS for House Bill 89, Labor and Commerce, version 024/R.
And that's a Labor and Commerce CS, not R. So it's the one that was referred to the committee. So thank you. Well, that's our working document. Go ahead. Identify yourself.
For the record, my name is Paula Scavera. I'm Special Assistant Legislative Liaison to the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development. With me is Cheryl Walsh, who is the Director of the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation in the Department. Yes, this bill will bring us in compliance with federal law and regulations, which we haven't been in compliance with for a while. I'm going to turn the microphone over to Cheryl. She can go in more in depth and hopefully answer all your questions.
Thank you and good afternoon. For the record, my name is Cheryl Walsh and I'm the Director of the Alaska Division of Vocational Rehabilitation. The State Vocational Rehabilitation Committee will function as a State Rehabilitation Council and the Assistive Technology Advisory Committee. Both of these are required by federal law to accept funding from the Department of Education Rehabilitation Services Administration. For us to accept our assistive technology grant and to accept client service, vocational rehabilitation, client services program funding, which we utilize to assist Alaskans with disabilities to obtain employment in a competitive labor market. The primary purpose for the legislation is to bring the current statutes into compliance with federal laws. The bill addresses the appointment, the number, and the composition of the committee members. It also addresses the term and the selection of the chair, the committee chair. It eliminates the need for the governor to appoint the chair. It allows the committee members to select the chair subject to disapproval from the governor. It also provides for 4 meetings per year, which can be conducted telephonically. When you consider the purpose and the regulatory responsibilities of this committee, the importance of the composition becomes more apparent. The committee members act as a voice for the consumers and the stakeholders of the public rehabilitation program. Current regulations require that a majority of the members are individuals who have a disability. The bill is allowed to allow the composition of the committee to change without revising the statutes if the federal regulations change. I understand that this has raised some concerns about the growth of the committee. The regulatory function of the committee is to coordinate the activities within other councils within the state. The purpose of this coordination is to reduce duplication and to lead to better efficiency and effectiveness of the committee. Several members on the committee have dual roles. They serve on the Workforce Investment Board or the Statewide Independent Living Council. And since the committee is funded with client service dollars, that we are very cognizant of the need to keep the committee just to the regulatory size. We're not interested in growing the size of the committee. And there's no paid staff that are on this committee at all. We keep the members lower by working diligently to make sure that we try to find people who meet two categories, say a business person who also has a disability, because that keeps down how many people who are on the committee. Because the membership for the Assistive Technology Committee and the State Rehabilitation Council are very similar, you can utilize the same individuals for that, so it works out really well. Membership that's described in current statute is related to a board that no longer exists, and it has individuals such as leaders in agriculture that really aren't very relevant to our program. In closing, I guess I'd like to address the value that this committee brings to the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation. This committee provides an external view. It provides an important external view as members assess the needs of Alaskans with disabilities. They survey customer satisfaction. They make recommendations. They review our policies and procedures from an external eye. They help us to develop the state rehabilitation plan. They keep the public program consumer-focused and relevant to the needs of employers and to individuals with disabilities. Since each of their quarterly meetings is held, they hold public testimony, and they open it up for an hour, and they receive that hour is always filled with public comment, and it really gives us a lot of good information for me as the administrator of the program, provide a really good service. I know that some of you have met with some of the community members last week, and they provided their annual report, and if you don't have a copy, I'd be happy to provide that. It gives information about their goals and responsibilities into further detail than what I've been able to provide today. I guess on a final note, I would like to say that also the change of the name of the committee to the State Vocational Rehabilitation Council will also help to end the confusion that sometimes occurs between the Governor's Committee on Employment and Rehabilitation of People with Disabilities with the Governor's Council on Disability and Special Ed. Because sometimes the public confuses the two, even though our role is very different. So if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Committee, you have any questions, clarification, or otherwise? Doesn't look like. I do have one. You said that there was some concern about tying this with federal regulation because of the growth of the projected growth of the committee. Is that what you said? And I was wondering, here's the question really, that had you thought about the fact that it puts it on automatic, you know, so that if there's something that the committee wanted to change or add to or whatever to make it a, you know, broader maybe than the federal regulation, that this kind of, you know, takes it away from the process.
Chairman Keller, actually, because we tie it to the regulations, the role and function of the committee is very specific, and so that's the sole purpose of the committee, is for oversight for the public program and for the assistive technology program. It came up in another committee about the membership, just because there wasn't a specific number named. Current regulations say that it needs a minimum of 15 members.
For the record, my name is Paula Scavera. We 3 years ago, this bill was before you, before the legislature, and we actually changed the language at the request of the legislature, because they go, why do you, we don't want you to keep coming in every time they change it plus or minus a couple members. So mm-hmm. that's why it, in the bill we actually put as prescribed by, you know, state reg or how we worded it, because otherwise we would have to keep coming in and changing the number of the members of the committee every time somebody in Washington, D.C. changed the number.
Yeah, thank you, Paula and Cheryl. The I appreciate that, and the reason for my question is just simply that, I mean, do you, let me put it this way. Do you feel like you can, let me back up just a little bit more. As I read through the federal regulations, I noticed that it specified the composition mm-hmm. of the board. And one of the things it requires, for example, is for business, labor, something, something. Okay, could you, do you think that, is that restrictive in any way? I mean, could you go in there and say, okay, we want one of those business members to also be an entrepreneur type person in business that's self-employed and you know, I mean, could you do that? Or I mean, and that's why I wonder, you know, I mean, this it removes it from the attention of legislature, and I was just wondering if you can make those kind of changes, do you think?
It allows us to have business, labor, or industry, and I think boards and commissions helps to solicit the applications, and then the governor appoints them to the board.
Right.
It has been helpful in the past to have a broad base of businesses, because we do assist individuals to become entrepreneurs, so different perspectives and different industry sectors yeah. would be, are helpful. But our access, our individual also serves on the Alaska Workforce Investment Board, can help us to bring that perspective from many businesses, so it's helpful.
Thank you. Thank you. It really probably wasn't a very fair question, but where it's coming from is I had the opportunity to tour a vocational rehabilitation program that I believe was in Minnesota, and it was so cool. They had a they bought a big building and they built a restaurant and they you know, had living, and their goal was to get people independent and employed, you know, and but it was, the people were actually running the restaurant that lived in the home, and it was so innovative and so refreshing. It was huge. I mean, you know, there was 50, 75 people that were coming and going onto that program. And I just was thinking, you know, it's a great system if we have, you know, if the composition of the board is such that you're looking for that kind of thing, you know, and I just.
For the record, Paula Scavira, we look at business in a very broad sense in our boards and have, and also in industry. Mm-hmm. If you're self-employed, you're a business, you know, if you're got one employee, you're a business. If you got 500, you're a business, you know. So we have always in the department looked at the word business very broadly.
Okay, thank you.
And I'd like to have the name of the facility you visited, because that would be kind of interesting to pass on to folks in the department.
Thank you. Is there no other questions? We have several people online that would like to testify, and so if you would, you can just stand by right there. If you like, Paula, there may be questions, if you don't mind. I mean, they're nice, comfortable chairs. I don't think there's anybody.
Let the color come down.
I think these are online. John Cannon, government.
Thank you, Chairman Keller.
Would you go ahead and identify yourself and your affiliation, please, and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is John Cannon. I live at 3101 Whispering Woods Drive in Wasilla. I serve on the Governor's Committee on Employment and Rehabilitation of Persons with Disabilities. Also I'm employed as Executive Director of Mattu Services for Children and Adults. I've worked in the disabilities field in Alaska since 1981, which is coming up on, hard to believe, but almost 30 years. In the disabilities field here in Alaska. Of course, I'm here today to speak for the passage of HB 89, and I wanted to thank Chair Keller and the members of the committee for hearing the bill today. First, I wanted to underscore what an honor it's been for me to serve on the committee and to try to do my part to give a voice to Alaskans with disabilities in Alaska's vocational rehabilitation system. The committee works in partnership with the DVR staff to maximize employment for Alaskans with disabilities. So it's a critically important committee to give many vulnerable Alaskans who don't have a voice in the system. As mentioned earlier, the purpose of HB 89 is to bring our committee into compliance with federal regulations. I wanted to emphasize that there's no fiscal note attached to the bill. I think that Cheryl and Paula did a great job in terms of covering the details. Two things I wanted to underscore related to HB 89 would be, first, changing the name from the Governor's Committee on Employment and Rehabilitation for Persons with Disabilities to the State Vocational Rehabilitation Committee, I think would really make our committee members happy. Because it's just a really lengthy name, and as Cheryl mentioned earlier, it really will reduce a lot of confusion, particularly with the Governor's Council on Special Education and Disabilities. Secondly, the bill calls for making the committee composition consistent with federal requirements. And I wanted to mention that it's my understanding that about 70% of DVR funds come from the federal government. So it's really important for Alaska to comply whenever possible with the federal requirements. Our committee reviewed and discussed HB 89 at length at more than one of our meetings, and there is unanimous support for the bill. So I would respectfully ask your committee's support. Please pass HB 89 out of committee to House Finance. You know, pretty much the passage of the bill is painless and comes with no additional cost. And it's our understanding that there is pretty strong support for the companion bill on the Senate side, SB 83. So we believe there's an excellent chance for the bill to pass this session. So your support for HB 89 is greatly appreciated. Thank you so much.
Thank you, John. Thank you both for your work and your advocacy. And if I can't put a name with a face, so if I know you, I'm sorry. But thank you for your testimony. And just for encouragement, I haven't really heard any negatives at all. We're just giving this due process. So thank you, John.
Great. Excellent. Thank you, Chair Keller.
Pam Stratton.
Good afternoon, Chairman Keller and committee members. I'm a member of the Governor's Committee on Employment and Rehabilitation of Disabilities.
Pam, if you would state your name and your affiliation for the record. It just helps our secretary get it down straight, so then proceed.
Sorry about that.
No, I should have told you.
My name is Pam Stratton. I'm at 8610 Witherspoon Circle in Anchorage, Alaska. I am the director of the Client Assistance Program for Alaska, and as that, I fill that seat on the Governor's Committee on Employment and Rehabilitation of People with Disabilities.
Proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. I was just calling to reiterate what Paula, Cheryl, and John have already informed you of in terms of the importance of passing this legislation so that we can be in compliance with federal regulation in terms of our membership requirements. And to thank you for considering that today, and I won't repeat everything that's already been said other than to say I'm in complete agreement with the statements that have been previously made.
Thank you, Pam. Does the committee have any questions? I see none, so thank you very much. Ron Boynton, are you there online?
He's gone?
Jim Burton? Okay.
The intent of the committee is not to move on the bill. It's just a matter of policy. That gives everybody on the committee chance to review these minutes and to discuss it between ourselves. Like I say, I know of no challenges, really, or questions that are outstanding. Just a little bit of unease on the part of tying it with a federal reg, and that's just, I think that's understandable. Mm-hmm. But I don't think there's anything there to be really concerned about. Just it should be on the record and talked about. So if there's no other questions, we're going to gavel out here, and we'll take action on this bill at a later committee under bills previously heard. And if there's any questions, we'll let you know, and we'll keep you posted.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, does the committee have anything further? I want to announce for the four of you that are left. Tomorrow we have another joint meeting at 1:30. It's the Health Commission is going to be making a report to the Joint HES Committee on the Senate schedule. And I'm pretty proud and excited about this report because I was engaged in that all summer. It took me away some fishing. but anyway, I'll see you tomorrow. Thank you. Okay. So we're gaveled out at